Welcome to the Rare and Remarkable podcast. My name is Kathleen Palmer, and I work at RR Auction. I'm here today with my boss, CMO Tricia Eaton, and we have a special guest in the studio with us today. His name is John Brennan, and he is a legend in the in-person collecting autographs world, and we are very excited at RR Auction to be offering select pieces of his copious collection that he has amassed over 40 years of incredible interactions with celebrities from all walks of life, growing right out of his passionate love of rock and roll music. And we have some really exciting things to share with fans, but we also want to talk about how fascinating John's experience in the hobby was and still continues to be to this day. And he's got some really great stories. Welcome, John.
Hey, how are you?
Great. It's really great to see you in person and hear some of your tales from the front lines of autograph collecting. Now, you started out pretty young, a lot younger than a lot of us probably would expect. So when did collecting and things like that start for you?
Well, when I was young, my parents wanted to keep me busy, so they introduced me to coin collecting and stamp collecting, baseball cards and that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was my initial stuff. And when I lost interest in that and found music, I started collecting records. And then that would be the beginning of this path that I ended up taking all the way to now.
What was your first album you bought?
Kiss Alive was the first album that really, you know, exploded in my life, mm-hmm. kind of like the way it opens up in the first chords on the album. That was it. Once I found that, there was no turning back.
Mm-hmm. And you were you just started a huge love of that classic rock in the 70s, early 80s. What were some of your favorite bands? What did you
well,
said?
Yeah, I was 11 when I found Kiss Alive, and then, you know, my neighbor up the street, she was cute. She was listening to Frampton Comes Alive by her pool, so that Frampton Comes Alive. Then obviously Aerosmith, Zeppelin, eventually Black Sabbath. Those were some of the early bands, and then the Stones. That I first started collecting.
And you were a Zeppelin fan from a really young age, didn't you have some stories about that?
Yeah, well, when I was really young, I started listening to Zeppelin, you know, like Whole Lot of Love. Those were the ones on the radio in Connecticut, Black Dog. And then around the same time, The Song Remains the Same was coming out in the theaters, and I was 11 or 12 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to go was to tell the parents that's what we got to do. So unfortunately for them, I dragged them to the theater. And I can only imagine what that was like. So, but they did it, so.
Nice. Now, as you said, you grew up in Connecticut. So you were within a reasonable distance to drive to New York City. So how did, and that's where a lot of things were happening. Now, what was your first autograph, and how did that sort of snowball in your life to where we're at today?
Well, the first time I got an autograph, it was random. I was on vacation with my parents in 79 in New Jersey, and you know, I had the fever at that point for music, so there was only thing going on when I was there was the Talking Heads and B-52s were playing across the street from where I was staying in Asbury Park. So, you know, I went to the show. Mm-hmm. I had heard Take Me to the River. So I went to that mm-hmm. show. It was cool. You know, I was at the point where I was starting to invite other genres besides hard rock in my life. So anyway, I was staying across the street at a hotel where the B-52s happened to be staying there.
Oh.
So I had the program from the show. So it was just, you know, that was, let's try this. So, you know, they're getting ready for breakfast. I'm down the lobby and I see them and I'm trying to get all of them to sign it. So that was the beginning, you know, and that never left my system.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still pretty young then. So it took a few years after that, more concerts, more driving around, more concerts, more traveling, concerts, and eventually started trying to figure out how to meet the band. I was, you know, sleeping out for tickets. I would mm-hmm. be in New Haven once I found where Van Halen was staying, and I got kind of close, but not close enough. So that just fueled it. Then another time I followed them from New Haven, Hartford, I think, to New York City. And that was the first time I entered the zone. And it was like, wow, oh my God. So as soon as I was there, I stayed there for days, mm-hmm. started meeting other people. And then I started seeing other people showing up. I was waiting there and Duran Duran comes pulling up. So it was just crazy times. It was exciting. Every minute you didn't know what was happening.
And that's at the Parker Meridian back in the day?
Yeah, it was Parker Meridian in spring of 84 was like when we really started going hard every day after mm-hmm. a few failed attempts and small successes before that. It was the spring of 84 when I was hit the city and never turned back.
Awesome. And it sounds like you ran into all kinds of people there. What was it? You mentioned Duran Duran was there and all their fangirls were there. And you ran into Jerry Garcia, I think, a few times.
Yeah,
there.
That hotel was like, it was a rather new hotel at the time. It was definitely the it place to stay. So, I mean, just some of the people I saw there was Jerry Garcia. I saw Julian Lennon before he had released his first album, Velot. Van Halen would stay there. You'd see all kinds of people there, from members of Kiss to Roger Daltrey to...
I think you followed Iron Maiden there once?
Iron Maiden I had followed there. That was probably 2 years, 1 or 2 years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the spot. So you would go there every day and, you know, I mean, eventually you'd see
somebody
everybody.
Was coming out.
Yeah, from Aerosmith and Heart to, you know, all the bands of the moment.
Awesome.
From, you know, Rick Springfield and Corey Hart. I mean, you know, it's just all kinds of people from the time.
How exciting for a teenager to just be inundated with the proximity of being with these people that you're listening to and loving. I mean, what a fan paradise.
Well, especially for me, because I came from a small town in Connecticut where it was not even, that thought didn't exist. You weren't coexisting like you are in LA or somewhere in a big city where like, oh yeah, you know, we see them eating or this or that. It was like, it was otherworldly, you know. Eventually, when I was in school, I'd bring a friend now and again, and, you know, they still use those pictures nowadays to tell stories, so... Mm-hmm. It was wild times.
Well, it's kind of cool that you were that close to New York City, so you could conceivably commute. Tell us about driving your car and perhaps maybe a celebrity sighting in your car.
Oh, well, the one time I was waiting, we were waiting for the Rolling Stones on 48th Street, which was considered like Music Row. And this was in, 86, I think. And they were there recording. And one night Mick came out and he had already known us from seeing us. 'Cause he lived in New York pretty much full time at that point.
A bunch of them did, right?
Yeah. Mick, Ron lived a few blocks apart at that time. And Keith lived downtown. So we would see them a lot. And, you know, we wouldn't see Charlie or Bill as much, but at this point we were seeing them because they were recording. But at that night, Mick actually came out alone, which was different for him. And he didn't have his car or his assistants and stuff. So, you know, he started signing for us and he couldn't find a car. And we initially asked him and he declined. And he's signing for us, and he couldn't find a cab, so it went on for a few minutes. And so we're just talking to him, and eventually I just asked him again. He's like, you know, all right, let's do it. So
you asked him what?
If he needed a ride.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
to his house?
Yeah,
or his apartment?
Yeah. And we, you know, he had already known us from seeing us guy. You know, it was like we were the guys, you know. So, and this was, you know, different times. So it was so laid back.
I know. Can you imagine a celebrity getting into anybody's car in this day and age? Probably not. I don't know.
It was just surreal. I mean, you know, I had to contain myself. He's sitting in the front seat with me and my friend was in the back.
Dying.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking and he was laid back and low key. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was kind of casual until we pulled up to one light And a guy looks over, just, you know, randomly.
Oh, no.
A guy just randomly looks over, you know, and he looks back. And then he just shoots hard left with his head. And he knows what he's looking at. And I'm like, yep. Wow, you know. And then, you know, I'm still driving, you know. So anyway, that was
terrific.
Crazy.
And now, in addition to the Stones, I mean, a lot of people were living out there, right? I mean, there were a lot of British musicians specifically that were keeping a place in the city. Was it Roger Waters, I believe, you mentioned once, and Bowie was there, and Sting maybe a little later.
Well, Bowie we used to see a lot at a hotel. I think he got his place later, but we always used to see him at a hotel in those times uptown. And you know, Waters was, I don't know if he was here at that point. He had also gotten a place later.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, and I think out east too. But we used to see Roger a lot walking around, not so much Bowie. We'd see Sting a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was, you know, back then Ron, Mick and Keith were around all the time. And there was other, you know, the New York artists were around, the Talking Heads and mm-hmm. Debbie Harry and other, you know, Lower East Side original punk icons. Lou Reed lived not too far away from Mick.
Yeah.
So we would see him a lot.
Cool. And then there's, of course, people filming movies and things, and that, you know, that was a hot spot, especially the St. Mark's Place neighborhood was a real hot spot. And I know you ran into a soon-to-be superstar while you were out that way.
Yeah, I had gotten a tip from a friend in the summer of 84 for Madonna. She was filming a movie that was going to be called Desperately Seeking Susan with Roseanne Arquette. And, you know, now those days things were laid back. So I just found my way over there. And sure enough, she's just sitting in a chair, you know, an actor's chair between takes with Roseanne. And we just walked up to her and she did a few pictures and signed a little bit. And, you know, she, classic Madonna, in charge of everything. She's like, I'm trying to work. You know, she was even
a diva early.
Yeah, she was in charge. But she was fairly friendly, and she signed some and took pictures. And this was only a few weeks before, you know, she hit the stage at MTV for Like a Virgin. And mm-hmm. then that was it. It was just
untouchable.
Yeah, it became, and it was, that was, you know, that was it quick. She couldn't go anywhere.
I think that's the most exciting thing to me, being of a similar age, is how you managed to meet these people with such like accessibility that we don't have anymore. I mean, you know, you have a beautiful picture there of you with Prince, and you know, nobody's going to be able to saunter up to him in the last 20 years. So I think it's just so exciting that you got to meet Madonna and Prince, and even people that were already superstars were still willing to talk and smile and get in your car. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, there was a few different occurrences where, you know, they would, oh, you got a car, mate? You know, I mean, one time I ended up driving Echo and the Bunnymen to a show. Some of them, not all of them. Another time I was the Scorpions back in the early days, sort of like blackout period. They used my car.
Mm.
Another time I had lunch with four out of the five Black Crows. I think they were also all in my car right before they were exploding. Shake Your Money Maker. Mm-hmm. It was early. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that was, you know,
down
some
earth
of it, some of it, like
stuff.
I have to see the pictures to remember like all of the mm-hmm. stories.
So that's right. That is John Brennan, rock and roll Uber driver to the stars. I'm going to throw it over to Trisha now, because she has lots of questions of her own as well.
So, John, you really started collecting full-time in about 1984, right?
Yeah.
If somebody had told you then what your collection would have become, what would you have said or thought?
It was, I had no idea of even knowing what I would ever get. I mean, it was just blind, you know, it was just, I was running headfirst into the fire, you know, but once I got the first signature, I mean, all that was, you know, gasoline on it. It just, you know, and my thing was like, my favorite bands were always bands, you know, it was Van Halen. So at that time I was nuts for Van Halen. It was 1984, the year, 1984, the album.
Yeah.
And I had already seen Van Halen on every tour, including the first one where they opened for Black Sabbath. So I was uber fan,
uber
mixed messages. So, you know, I needed to get the groups to sign my stuff. So, I mean, Eddie was friendly, Alex was friendly, Michael was friendly, but David was difficult. So from the start, the passion only grew from the difficulty of getting the album signed by every member in the group. You know, that was one of the first ones, was really trying to get David Lee Roth, or, you know, eventually it was Aerosmith, but they were pretty friendly at the time, and other groups. And then Black Sabbath, who were not together in the early 80s with the original lineup. And, you know, and that's what part of the fuel was, because I was never quitting, because there was always one more name I needed to add onto the album. So, I mean, I didn't realize, you just start collecting and collecting and collecting, and knowing what you're doing is fun. And at those times, you know, it was a fan experience. You go to all the shows, you'd run up to whoever it was, and you could talk to them about the show. So it was an interaction that, it's changed now. It's not the same, but yeah, you know, they were more welcoming. And but yeah, I had no idea that a collection would turn into what it did. It's a monster.
What did your parents think when you're being all crazy, running around getting autographs like this?
Piling them in your room somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, at that time I was living with my father. And, you know, in the beginning it was all right, you know. And, but then eventually it came down to, like, what's going on?
What are you doing with your life, John?
Yeah, well, I was going to school. And, you know, I was doing that for the family. I mean, I didn't know all this, but I mean, I knew, you know, it was blocked somewhere inside the back of my head, but
that you were not going to be going into the family business.
Yeah. I mean, they tried. That's for sure. And eventually, you know, they came to, I mean, accept it a little bit, but, it wasn't until much later, you know.
I mean, I don't see how you could, a 9-to-5 job could compare to running around New York City and or following Van Halen around the country. I mean, how can you settle down after that? I don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a hardcore, you know, hobby that turned into like a massive addiction, and it was an addiction that you didn't wake up with a hangover.
That's right.
And you know, you didn't need to see anything. It was all.
Always one more signature to get.
Yeah, I mean, another record to buy. I was hot, really. I mean, it was about collecting the music first. I would not go for a lot of artists that I wasn't a fan of. You know, I was really, in the beginning especially, I was like, you know, these are my groups. I love my hard, heavy rock. You know, eventually I started getting into punk. I started like, oh, the Sex Pistols, they're nasty. You know, they're heavy. This is great, you know. And then the Clash. And then eventually the Police. And
I know you had some resistance to the Police.
Yeah, you know, in the beginning.
You
know,
realized.
I mean, when I first started, it was Black Sabbath and Eddie Van Halen and Jimmy Page. I mean, Richie Blackmore. And that was the stuff. And
mm-hmm.
It still is. You know, you go back to that stuff and it's timeless in your mind because it was prolific moments that, you know, when you're at that age, they stay there forever.
Yeah, it's your pivotal time of coming into yourself, and it's, yeah, it stays embedded for sure.
I think what's unique about your collection is that you really went after what you loved and you were a fan first.
Yeah, that was really it. That was only it, you know. And as I, you know, was buying more records, like I would be collecting The Cure, and at that time they would release every song in 900 different formats, and you know,
sure, them all signed.
Sure enough, I'm buying all of them, every 45, every picture disc, every shape disc, every colored vinyl, you know, every 12-inch, every 12-inch remix, you know, and I'm buying test pressings and acetates and, you know, and then it has to be every country with every different cover. So yeah, it was like the collector's dream. And then, you know, got to get them signed. Where's Robert Smith?
You know. Do they know you personally at the record store?
Well, at the time when all those stores were open in the Village, yeah, they knew me very well. I used to have, they coined me the nickname Dude. That was my original nickname. So yeah, I was always at Subterranean was one of them. Record Runner was another one. Then another one opened later called Rebel Rebel. Then there was one on the east side called Sounds. On 8th Street, there was It's Only Rock and Roll. And then there was a disco one. I think it was off of Bleecker Street that I bought a lot of early Madonna stuff at. So, yeah, and then I'd be on in the magazines buying stuff through the collector magazines, which was Goldmine at the time. Mm-hmm. And Record Collector was the English one. So it was endless.
So how many different bands did you follow on tour in the 80s, do you think?
Well, Van Halen was one of the first ones. Aerosmith I would have, but they were not really together when I first started, when I was old enough to do it. Van Halen was kind of still doing it in the mid 80s when I was old enough to start driving. I'd go to all the local shows, but then after that, I think by Fair Warning and 1984, those tours, I was, you know, at that point I was able to cut my chains and get out.
And you got backstage with Van Halen quite a bit. I mean, I love that story of, it's like you hanging out with a whole bunch of famous celebrities and that was
the time. It was 84, and they were staying at that hotel, the Parker Meridian. Mm-hmm. And at that place, I had met Julian Lennon, who was there, I guess, preparing for his career, you know, doing the stuff, and he was there with his manager. And I was hanging out there every day, so I got to talking to him, and he actually brought me to that concert, and they were backstage, and you know, sure enough, I'm there hanging out with him, but I was just kind of friendly with him. I was there to meet Van Halen and see the show, so there mm-hmm. I am backstage, and you know, people in Van Halen are fawning over Julian. You know, oh my God, you're dead, and you changed my life, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm there and looking at Eddie and hoping David Lee will come in the room and so he can sign my stuff. So it was crazy. We were in this room and Eddie was back there and he was saying he was a better piano player than he was a guitar player. And I was, you know, those were wild times. A party atmosphere, totally different than what you see now.
What do you mean?
It was just wild. You know,
it's less wild now.
Yeah. I mean, well, backstage then was like it wasn't the myth. It was the reality.
Yeah.
Now I think, you know, it's just, you know, it's a lot different.
Yeah. Fair enough.
How has collecting changed?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to totally put it into perspective. But if I remove myself, if I said how it was in 1984... When I would drive 75 miles from my house into the city, not really knowing anything, and you would drive around and try to figure out and meet people, go to the shows and try to hope to find out where people were. There were no cell phones. There was no social media. There was very, very few people that were trying to do the same thing, if ever. And from my point of view with some of these music artists, I was like the only guy, you know, that was like collecting some of these obscure bands. You know, you would see a lot of people for Van Halen or any of the bigger names. But, I mean, you know, you really had to figure it out back then. And, you know, you were able to also get a little bit more access and able to talk to them, and they were more engaging. as opposed to a predisposed notion of why you're there, which you see nowadays, as well as nowadays all the other stuff comes into play, where a lot of people will post where someone is on the internet, or, you know, they won't sign an autograph or allow you to take a picture unless you're paying for it. And, you know, there's a danger aspect. It's just, and there's always, for a lot of the younger artists, there's just massive crowds.
Mm-hmm.
For like, say, a Justin Bieber. I mean, if that guy can be anywhere and there's 25 girls looking for him. Mm-hmm. Anywhere, getting ice cream, walking. And then they're all hitting each other off on the phone and boom, 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 boom. Here he is. And then,
yeah,
you know.
And, I mean, even getting a photo was not the way it is these days. I mean, there was a multi-step process to all these beautiful signed photos you have with celebrities.
Yeah, I see a lot of pictures on the internet now where, you know, there's half a head, you know, there's a side angle, it's dark, and, you know, people are just holding their phone out. And back in the day, we would have to, you know, buy a camera and then hope that the celebrity has someone with them, or we would have someone with us that's willing to take a picture, also able to take a picture, because every different person didn't know how to use the camera. And then if you did get a picture, you didn't know what you were getting, because you would have to go. And usually then we would absolutely, you know, oh my God, I just got a picture with Steven Tyler.
I hope my eyes were open.
Yeah. I mean, I hope it's not blurry. And we run to whatever photo store we could and hope we could get it back the same day. Usually not. And then a lot of times we'd want to blow the picture up into an 8x10 to get it signed. And then that's a whole nother process that took a couple of days. So it was the anxiety and the anticipation was huge for the whole thing. It always kept building into a crescendo. And then you're at the photo place and you're not even paying for the photos. You're just grabbing them out of this, you know, ripping them open before you even pay for them, because you're just so excited.
I mean, imagine if that picture of you and Dylan hadn't come out. I mean, that would have been a bummer.
Yeah, it happened a few times, but I mean, fortunately, that one, I was real lucky. I mean, there were times when the camera doesn't go off, or it's super blurry, or the flash isn't working because of the situation, and the celebrity runs away. And I mean, it was just stuff, a lot of stuff. And now it's just different. Hold your phone up, boom.
So you're kind of like an in-person collecting pioneer, kind of learning it out, like, as you go.
Yeah, learning how to use a pen, learning what marker to use, what markers we liked. I mean, there's this huge myth out there with celebrities that don't use blue.
Yeah, what is that?
Don't use blue.
Because it doesn't halo, right? You know,
they actually have some kind of thing where they actually think that if it's blue, it's money. I mean, it just looked better. That's why we started it. It projected better. I mean, okay, you don't want to use blue. I mean, that's what people want.
Well,
I mean, but
I thought
a lot
the black,
of them will actually
like,
say
haloed if you use the black Sharpie.
But is that why they don't want to sign? Because they want it to be damaged? I mean, they like, I'm not using blue.
No, to not be damaged with the black and get like the halo around it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I really would love to get feedback.
So I think
if there's anybody
thought, like,
out
blue
there
meant people were going to go sell it.
Yeah. There was this whole myth about blue.
Well, it's funny because it sounds like it's from two different angles here. You have the superstition version, and
I have the selling
Trisha's
version.
The selling professional signature evaluator.
Yeah, version. I mean, I definitely think the selling thing was the original thing, but they had this thing about why, besides just selling, well, they can wipe that one off, or here, use this one, or it was, and I think, I mean, the perception, it's been written about, and I believe a Pearl Jam song where they actually acknowledge it. Blue penners.
blue penners.
Yeah. As
professionals.
Yeah.
I would base that on the style of the photograph. If it was dark, or if it had a nice white space, or if it was color versus black and white, it's like, well, the blue pen would look good with this or the black pen, but.
But sometimes you don't get a choice what they sign in, right?
Yeah. Sometimes actually embellished into almost always, especially nowadays, you know, sometimes someone was really engaging and they would talk to everybody and change the pen and sign exactly where you want to. And then there was other times where there was just no chance. there's one pen in their hand and
they're just whipping them out and on their way out.
Yeah, and they don't care where they sign. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of everything.
40 years of collecting, we could talk to you for hours. but we definitely want to talk more in the future with John because he has so many incredible in-person autograph stories. But we will leave you today here. And if you enjoyed our podcast, please do take a moment to leave us a review and follow us on iTunes. Join us for more rare and remarkable behind-the-scenes stories from industry insiders and experts. I'm Kathleen Palmer for Our Auction. Thanks for joining us.